From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is it crazy to diagnose the president's mental health? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. Several thousand psychotherapists have signed a petition describing President Trump as a malignant narcissist, calling for his removal from office. Others in their profession call that narcissistic and unethical, based on the false presumption that mental illness can be diagnosed from a distance. It's an issue that hasn't been raised in politics since the 1960s, but Trump's behavior has brought it back into the public arena. Will it help Congress decide if the president's fit to serve? Or will it politicize and discredit a profession to the detriment of both therapists and their patients? On today's Talking Point later, liberal activists challenge oil company power in a town near San Francisco. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. When columnists for the New York Times and the Washington Post called President Trump obviously mentally ill and just plain crazy, nobody took them seriously. Now, thousands of psychotherapists say a personality disorder makes him unfit to serve. Will that discredit their profession? More than it will, America's elected chief executive. Today's Talking Point, Richmond, California is a largely minority town in the Bay Area, dominated by a gasoline refinery. We'll talk with a liberal activist from New England who says community organizing has made a real difference there, with the Trump era just beginning. First, this news update. Donald Trump used to criticize President Obama for taxpayer-funded getaways to play golf. Now that he's president, the Secret Service, the Department of Homeland Security, and even the Coast Guard are racking up expenses like they've never seen before. The Washington Post reports that the chief executive and his family like to travel. Amy Britton is an investigative reporter for the Washington Post. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to Trump Tower and the trips to Mar-a-Lago, what about the president's son when they go to other countries, including the United Arab Emirates, to open hotels?
Right. Well, the interesting thing about the Suns is that, you know, they are going to be traveling the world to promote their brand, which is the Trump Organization, the family business. And although the administration has pledged a clear division between President Trump's company, the Trump Organization, and the White House, because of the nature of the security required for the first family, every time they go to one of these countries, they are essentially going to be backed by the full force of the U.S. government through U.S. Secret Service, through embassy staff, through consulate staff, and whatever country that they're visiting. So they're going in with perhaps dozens of security officials, U.S. officials surrounding them, and that certainly kind of lends an air of credibility to these trips.
When Trump took a trip to promote the Trump brand condo tower in Uruguay, you report that it cost the government $100,000.
Right, and that was just in hotel bills alone. So the interesting thing about these trips is that we may not know for months or perhaps years the full extent of the cost to U.S. taxpayers, but because of a purchasing order that we were able to review from the federal government, we know that there was a bill of about $98,000 in hotel rooms for Secret Service and for embassy staff in Uruguay just for his visit. And we're only talking about two, perhaps three nights to rack up that type of expense. So you can imagine how these expenses are going to accumulate throughout the 4 years.
Well, what about all the trips, the family trips, to Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida?
Right. So it's been interesting to watch the patterns, I guess, throughout the first month of his presidency. He's already been to Mar-a-Lago three times. So he's spent roughly between 20 to 25% of his days so far in the presidency in Florida at the Mar-a-Lago. And I guess we weren't really expecting that much of a frequent travel pattern right off the bat, because when he was running for office, he pledged that he would rarely leave the White House. But instead, we've seen him essentially kind of take the White House on the road and, you know, turn Mar-a-Lago into type of like a mobile White House situation where, you know, you see these kind of sensitive security situations, the sensitive security discussions happening with the Prime Minister of Japan, kind of happening out in the open at the Mar-a-Lago. I mean, it's almost unprecedented.
The president likes to be surrounded by crowds of people, and that's expensive.
It is. It is. And, you know, Donald Trump has made it clear that he's running a different type of presidency, right? So perhaps we should have expected this, that he was going to change the way this office works. And the idea of kind of having these sensitive discussions out in the open among paying members of the Mar-a-Lago, I mean, you can just imagine all the security concerns that would be kind of at stake here, right? You have individuals who have paid $200,000 to join this club, $14,000 a year membership, and they get access to the beach and they get access to the president nearly every weekend, you know, off the bat. And that raises a lot of concerns about screening all of these individuals as they're coming in for the weekend, screening everyone who's going to a wedding there, you know, when the president is there. And just by Trump's nature, he likes to be around people. So it doesn't seem like this would be likely to change. Perhaps as we get into the warmer months, maybe he'll go north. Maybe he'll spend time at his golf course in Bedminster. They're certainly prepared for up to 10 visits a year is what they have possibly estimated up there.
When he's at Mar-a-Lago, he has to have a Coast Guard vessel offshore, as I understand it. When the Secret Service and the other security people stay at Mar-a-Lago or at Trump Tower in New York City, who gets the money?
You know, that unfortunately is something that they have not disclosed, and we have been working really hard to try to get that information because we believe it's crucial information, especially if the Secret Service is paying the Trump Organization directly to rent space for them. You know, that's money that's going directly to Trump's company. You know, we're essentially paying his company to rent space, and DOD has already come out and said that they're going to rent space from Trump Tower. I would imagine, even though they had not said so publicly, I would imagine that given the frequency of his travel to Mar-a-Lago, they would need to rent space there. We filed Freedom of Information Act requests. We're hoping to get that information about the rental agreements and how much money it is costing.
All right, we'll see, and then we'll multiply by 4 years. Amy Britton, again, investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks so much.
In a moment, is it crazy to diagnose the president's mental health? This is To the Point from Public Radio International.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. When Republican Barry Goldwater ran for president in 1964, a magazine called Fact published an article headlined, 1,189 psychiatrists say Goldwater is psychologically unfit to be president. The American Psychiatric Association then issued the so-called Goldwater Rule, calling it unethical to offer a professional opinion without an examination of the person in question. Now, the Goldwater Rule is being challenged by psychotherapists. John Gartner has written an online petition titled, Mental Health Professionals Declare Donald Trump is Mentally Ill and Must Be Removed. It's been signed by 23,000 people. Gartner is a practicing psychologist who taught at Johns Hopkins University Medical School. He's now an author. And John Gartner, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you very much for having me, especially about this such important issue.
Why are you doing this? Why do you think it's ethical, contrary to what the American Psychiatric Association said in 1964?
Well, I think there's two-part answer to that question. One is, can we form a valid diagnosis of Donald Trump? And two, is it ethical to do so? I think in some ways we're fighting the last war in this situation, because when that Goldwater situation took place, that was, I'm now addressing the can we do it in a valid way, that was before we had the DSM. So the psychiatrists were giving
what's the DSM?
The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which came into effect in 1980, has very clear behavioral criteria for every disorder, written in very plain English. During the Goldwater era, we did not have such an objective document, and so it was Freudian saying that he had potty training issues or latent homosexuality or Oedipal issues. So a lot of constructs that may not have been valid, and they certainly couldn't have known about without treating Barry Goldwater. However, do I need to examine Donald Trump, for example, to know, and I'm reading now from the DSM criteria for antisocial personality disorder, which I believe is just one of the personality disorders he has. I think he also meets criteria for paranoid and narcissistic, a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others. Well, we have 12 women who say he has sexually assaulted them, and he has bragged about it. We know that he had a fraudulent university to bilk people out of money, Trump University. I'd say that's a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others. And then you have to meet three of the following criteria. Deceitfulness is indicated by repeated lying. Check. Impulsivity. Check. Irritability and aggressiveness. Check. Consistent irresponsibility, such as not honoring financial obligations, like not paying dozens and dozens of workmen their due, and lack of remorse. We've never seen Donald Trump say he was sorry. So we've just now, in record time, shown, yes, in common sense language, from the observations, and we have multiple observations that many people have made over an extended period of time, show that he does demonstrate those behaviors. So that's the technical aspect. But let's talk about the moral aspect. In psychiatry, we also have what's called a duty to warn. Confidentiality is one of our core ethics. But if your patient says he might harm someone, you're obligated to warn that person. That trumps confidentiality. I would say that with our special understanding as mental health professionals, we're able to see the unique danger that Donald Trump represents to the country and to the world. And for us to remain silent, to me, is the most unethical behavior I could imagine. And history will not judge us kindly. Because if his presidency is as destructive and catastrophic as I believe it's going to be, and we had special insight into the danger that he posed, and we said nothing, we will not be regarded as having been ethical.
John Gardner, once again, a psychologist, author of the online petition, Mental Health Professionals Declare Trump is Mentally Ill and Must Be Removed. I understand you have about 23,000 signatures on that. You don't know that all of them are necessarily professionals, do you?
Well, actually, between our petition and Congressman Bass, who has a similar petition, we're actually up to 60,000 signatures between the two petitions. Mm-hmm. Although it's true, even though the petition was only sent to mental health groups, and the instructions say it's only for mental health groups, it's in the title, it's in the body of the petition, and I've sent emails to everyone who signed. If you're not a mental health professional, please take your name off. I can't personally police every signature. But in 3 weeks, we have 60,000 people who claim to be mental health professionals who are saying the same thing that I'm saying. They may not have the stature to be on your radio show, but they are speaking out publicly because they, too, through their psychological understanding, can see the unique and present danger that Donald Trump poses.
Let me point out that the writer of the Standard Manual on Psychiatric Disorders has not just rejected your petition, but has written extensively about it in a letter to the New York Times. So has Paul Applebaum rejected it. He is the Dollard Professor of Psychiatry, Medicine, and Law at Columbia University. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What's wrong with this? Is it A, impossible to diagnose from a distance? Is it B, morally unethical to reveal it if you do?
So I think it's C, all of the above. It's impossible to diagnose from a distance because the DSM diagnostic criteria are not intended to be used as a checklist. And I speak as the chair of the DSM steering committee that is in charge of revising the manual. A skilled diagnostician, a psychiatrist or another mental health professional, doesn't simply go down a checklist and ask which symptoms are present. The psychiatrist inquires into the background of a person's situation to try to understand what might be underlying the symptoms that are there. So the same complex of symptoms could, in the instance that we're talking about today, reflect narcissistic personality disorder, bipolar disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, antisocial personality disorder, substance use disorder, some combination of the above, or somebody who has learned over an extended period of time to project a public persona that works well for him and who otherwise has no psychiatric diagnosis whatsoever. And without a careful in-person evaluation of the person about whom a diagnosis is being made, it's impossible to distinguish among those alternatives.
So it all might be an act, is what you're saying.
It all might be an act. That's right. And if it is, I think we'd have to agree it's been a remarkably successful one, both in business and more recently in politics.
What if it's not an act? And if it's not, then is it unethical to be silent?
So let me turn to the ethics question. The reason the American Psychiatric Association adopted the Goldwater rule in 1973 is because
later than I thought. Go ahead.
A little later than you thought, but to be sure, reflecting the episode in 1964, is because of concern about the consequences of the psychiatrists who responded to that survey and other mental health professionals who did similar things. And the consequences that we worry about are that the public's view of mental health, which is already heavily stigmatized and a stigma that has to be overcome by many people before they seek treatment for themselves, even when they need it very much, is likely only to be made worse by the picture of mental health professionals doing what manifestly can't be done, namely diagnosing people who they've never met or evaluated. Oddly enough, it always seems as though those diagnoses that are made correspond to the diagnoser's political preferences. It's always the other side who has a candidate who's mentally ill, and never the side that that you're on.
Let me go back to John Gartner. What, in fact, if the president is just acting in order to construct what has been described as a very successful public persona? If he is, then are you concerned about discrediting your own profession if you are, in fact, criticizing him as somebody who you disagree with politically?
Well, let me say this is not a partisan effort. I disagreed with George Bush politically. It never occurred to me that he was dangerously mentally ill, as I believe Donald Trump is. In a way, your question is he crazy or is he evil or is he both? I actually think he's both. Declaring that he had the largest popular vote, that he won the popular vote and the largest inauguration crowd in history is either delusional or the most brazen lie possible or some combination thereof.
His supporters seem to love it.
Well, that may be, but this malignant narcissism that was the combination of these three personality disorders, where you are both narcissistic and you are paranoid, so you see conspiracies everywhere. And some of the conspiracies that Donald Trump has endorsed are simply crazy and delusional. There's simply no other word for it. He said that Barack Obama ordered the murder of the head of Vital Records in Hawaii to stop the truth of his birth certificates from coming out. He claimed that Hillary Clinton had Antonin Scalia murdered, that Ted Cruz's father was part of the Kennedy assassination. I mean, this is like three of like 100 conspiracy theories that he's endorsed.
So, Paul Elbebaum, do those kinds of examples, all of which is we've been hearing about for a long period of time, strengthen the case for the possibility that something's really wrong and that we ought to be concerned?
Well, I don't think they strengthen the case because they don't help us sort out any of the alternative explanations that I pointed to earlier. But I think the examples point to one reason why the contribution of mental health professionals to this debate is much less than many of them think it will be when they sign petitions or make statements of this sort. And that is the only thing mental health professionals can legitimately do in a circumstance like this is describe the behavior that they see. And Dr. Gartner has done some of that just now. But frankly, look, I've been in practice for 37 years. You don't need me to describe Donald Trump's behavior for you. You don't need me to tell you that he's got a big ego or that he distorts the facts or whatever else you've observed about his erratic behavior before and since becoming president. Anybody can observe that for themselves. And in fact, if you comb through the opinion pages of our newspapers, you'll see that most of our political columnists on both sides of the aisle seem to have figured that out already. They didn't need me or Dr. Gartner to tell them about that.
They have used phrases like just plain crazy and obviously mentally ill. Again, Paul Applebaum is Dollard Professor of Psychiatry, Medicine, and Law at Columbia University. I want to go to another guest, Tom Nichols, who's author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. He also teaches national security at the Naval War College. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think is the impact of what we're hearing here when professionals such as John Gartner and the others who have signed the petition get involved in politics in the way that they have?
Well, and first I should say this is my own view, but I think it's deeply dangerous when professionals try to substitute their judgment for the constitutional and democratic mechanisms in our system. The fact of the matter is that there are mechanisms for dealing with a president who may be incapacitated. There are legal and constitutional recourses. And we simply, I think it undermines the foundational small-r Republican notion of our entire system of government to simply say that experts can change the government merely by fiat. This would be like having expert witnesses walk into a courtroom and be able to send the jury and the judge and everybody else home to say, listen, we've reached a determination. We think the defendant is, you know, sane or insane or whatever condition we think he has, and the jury can be dismissed.
But what I understand, what John Gartner's petition asks is that based on the information that he and others have put together, the Congress ought then to apply the 25th Amendment, which provides for the removal of the president. Presumably, then they'd have to investigate further as to whether he's unfit to serve.
Well, Congress doesn't apply the 25th Amendment. The cabinet does.
Okay. Excuse me. Thank you.
Congress can impeach, and of course, people always wonder what an impeachable offense is, and it's whatever Congress thinks it is. So there are, you know, very broad mechanisms for doing this. And I have no quarrel with professionals contacting elected representatives to say, look, I'm expressing my professional view. This is my advice. This is how I see the problem. But at that point, it does have to be, as I call them, the knowers have to hand over responsibility to the deciders, because those are the only people that can be held responsible for whatever happens next. If doctors or other mental health professionals render this kind of judgment, they're not the ones that will have to answer to the American public. And I think, again, that's very destructive and very corrosive to the role of expertise. And I this is ironic for me to say, because in the book, I actually argue that people really need to listen to experts more than they do, that I find very disturbing this attack on experts and the dismissal of their expertise. But I also warn, and I think it's a warning that we always have to keep in mind in a very complicated, large republic like we have, that experts cannot supplant the people who are elected and responsible to the public for those decisions.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back, continue this conversation. On our talking point later, liberal activism challenges oil company power in a town near San Francisco. Back in a moment with To The Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're only back with To The Point, having a debate today about whether, in fact, it is possible to diagnose mental illness from a distance and do so for the President of the United States particularly, and whether it's ethical then not to report it if you believe that he is, in fact, mentally ill. I should point out that Republican Jason Chaffetz of Utah has talked about a requirement that future presidents take mental health exams, and a Democrat, Ted Lieu of California, has a bill to require that psychotherapists be on staff at the White House. There's also already a requirement that there be a White House physician. Tom Nichols, back to you with the death of expertise. How concerned are you that the profession of psychology and psychotherapy is going to be damaged by what's happening?
I worry that any profession that wades too far into that kind of political debate damages its own standing and its own claim to expertise. As one of your guests pointed out earlier, it's always the other guy who's crazy. During the election, I recall that there were arguments that Hillary Clinton was incapable of serving, that her health was, that there were rumors that were begun about her, that her health was simply prohibited her from serving as president, and similar kinds of arguments. And I think it's important for medical professionals not to put themselves, or any expert, I should say, to put themselves forward as dispositive, to say that our judgment therefore overrules the decisions made by people who are elected and accountable to the American people. I mean, I suppose some of this just boils down to the reality that the people have the right to be wrong. But it's also important to remember that there are mechanisms in place, that the United States is a large and complicated system that does build in circuit breakers on things like a president who becomes incapacitated or a president who begins to act outside the law. There are other branches of government. And I think it would be deeply destructive to elevate experts, who I actually think should be listened to more in most venues, but certainly not elevated to the point where they take the place of elected decision makers. I think that'd be highly dangerous.
Tom Nichols, author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Back to John Gartner, who has circulated this petition. Mental health professionals declare Trump is mentally ill and must be removed. Are you intending, as our other guests have suggested, to substitute your judgment and that of other professionals in your field for the constitutional mechanisms that are required? Or are you saying that we should call on the cabinet, which the 25th Amendment gives the power to make a judgment about the president? And are you intending then to invoke that constitutional provision?
Well, that's what the petition says. But look, I'm a realist. I don't think there's a snowball's chance in hell that the president is going to be removed because of something petitioned from a bunch of mental health professionals. But you mentioned Chaffetz and Lieu. In addition, there's Karen Bass and also another senator from, another representative from Oregon, whose name, Blumen something, I'm blocking out it, I'm sorry, all of whom have introduced ideas like this. But as well, there's talk, Al Franken has talked about this, Bernstein has talked about this, that Republican politicians are secretly speaking among themselves that they are alarmed that Donald Trump may not be sane. It's not something they're saying publicly. But they are themselves alarmed and concerned about his sanity.
Well, then aren't they the ones who ought to do something about it?
Damn straight. Now, will they? That's the question, whether they'll have the political will and the moral fiber to act on what is sort of right there in front of us. I mean, when the first day of his presidency, instead of bringing the people together, instead of solving the nation's problems, he basically airs a narcissistic grievance and a grandiose delusion. He is showing from day one that his psychiatric impairment makes him incapable of doing the job of president. It's screamingly obvious. That's true, even to a non-professional.
Okay. Let me introduce one more voice on this program, Mark Updegrove, who's historian and director of the LBJ Presidential Library. He's also author of several books, and most recently, Indomitable Will, LBJ in the Presidency. Good to have you in our program.
Nice to be here, Warren.
Let's talk about this historically. Wasn't LBJ thought to be, on the part of some of his staff people, bipolar?
Yes, there was talk there about his erratic behavior at times, but it didn't affect his decision making, and that's the big difference here. There were musings that he might be suffering from depression or something, but that was just his staff members speculating. That was not any sort of medical diagnosis. There was also the same speculation about Richard Nixon at the height of Watergate, when he was wholly disengaged from the duties of president, and they were being the world was being largely run by Henry Kissinger and the nation by Alexander Haig. But we've never seen anything quite like this in presidential history.
What about Abraham Lincoln?
Well, again, Lincoln had the enormous burden of the Civil War on his hands, and there was talk that he was depressed. He did suffer from, in his words, melancholy, but you didn't see it in any manifest way publicly. And again, that's the big difference here.
What is the how different is it in this sense that we are having this debate on this program, and op-ed pages and various websites have been having the same conversation that we are? Is that something that makes this very different from what's happened in the past?
You know, as your guests have pointed out, there has always been speculation that the other guy is mentally unstable. It's an effective political tactic in many cases, but I don't think we've seen anything like this so soon in a president's term. I mean, the president hasn't been in office for even a month's time, and there's so many things that are unprecedented about this president in particular. Not the least of which is there has been no honeymoon after he took office. And we saw in the campaign a raging populist, but we saw him raging as a president-elect, and now we see him raging as a president, which has led to all the talk that you've alluded to.
So that's a different kind of evidence then that has been brought forward with regard to other presidents.
Well, I mean, whether it's evidence or not, these are observations that we are making about the public appearances of Donald Trump. What I mentioned with those other presidents, Lincoln, Johnson, Nixon, those were observations that staff members saw behind the scenes, and there was speculation and talk. But again, I want to make it clear, we didn't see any manifestation of mental illness relating to those presidents in terms of their policy. Their ability to make decisions seemed relatively sound. Warren, I want to make one point, and that is that this the fourth article in the 25th Amendment has been referred to several times. That is this sort of mental, this inability clause. That can be triggered by either a majority of the principal officers of the executive departments, meaning the cabinet, or in the words of the 25th Amendment, such other body as Congress. So in other words, if there is a majority vote either by the vice president and the majority of Congress or the majority of the cabinet, that triggers this motion.
Well, thanks for that, and thanks for making the distinction between observation and evidence. Obviously, that's crucial to the conversation that we are having. I want to go back to Paul Applebaum, the Dollard Professor of Psychiatry, Medicine, and Law at Columbia University. You were objected very much to the petition. We just heard John Gartner say he doesn't think the petition is going to actually cause anything to happen, but that it will, or hopefully has, already suggested legislation that has been approved and, or excuse me, that has been proposed. And if, in fact, legislation of that kind were to be approved, would that, in fact, do you think, justify what he's doing?
Look, I don't think the ends justify the means when the means themselves are as problematic as these are. If Donald Trump fails to complete his term involuntarily, I think it's likely, and in fact, it should be the case that it's because of either a clear inability to serve as president or because his own party decides that he constitutes a political liability for them. Until that happens, neither the cabinet nor the Congress is going to agree to his removal. We ought to be debating his policies. You know, I think we have distracted ourselves as a nation, and probably to his advantage, by endless debates about his mental health as opposed to the policies that he's proposing and whether they make sense for this country or not.
Mark Updegrove, back to you, our historian at the LBJ Presidential Library. Reference was made to the fact by yourself that this has happened very early in President Trump's term, and now we've heard the suggestion that over time this may or may not manifest itself in one way or another. What about the toll that the presidency takes on individuals? And, you know, we all know that inevitably they look a lot older by the end of their terms than they did at the beginning. In what other ways does this job stress people?
Oh, my gosh, in every way possible. You mentioned Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln not only dealt with the burden of the Civil War, which is, I think, indisputably the greatest crisis that our country ever faced, but he was also dealing with the death of his son, a wife who was becoming emotionally unstable, and there were so many crises that he was dealing with at any given time. This job is unlike any other. I think and that can take a toll on one's psyche. But I think what we have frequently seen in history is it stretches the person who's in the office. It makes them bigger. And I'm not sure we're seeing that in this case. We're almost invariably, when you walk into that office, you realize the awesome burden that you're now carrying as the president of the United States. And you put your country invariably above yourself. We've seen that with every president, and I think it's made every president a bigger presence. They've seen the manifest importance of what they do. I'm not sure we've seen that from Donald Trump yet. This is a person who's still obsessed with the number of people who attended his inauguration celebration. Usually a president moves on and worries about the duties at hand.
Well, we can only hope for the best. Tom Nichols, back to you. Again, your book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters, and you're a defender of established knowledge. What other professions, beside the one we're talking about, the profession of psychotherapy, have, in fact, put themselves at risk, if you will, by becoming excessively political?
Well, you can go back to the Gulf War and look at the academic community, the specialists in international relations who took out an entire page ad in the New York Times arguing against it. I think they would argue that they were on the right side of that issue. You've seen many other professions, for example, lawyers, when it comes to Supreme Court justices, putting themselves out there to argue whether or not justice should be confirmed or not. But again, in all of these cases, these are appeals, as it should be, to elected officials. And one point I would like to make about this is if you create a particular body, for example, if Congress appoints a, you know, presidential watchdog commission or whatever that other body created by Congress might be, it's also dangerous to constitutional and democratic norms because it's letting everybody off the hook. It's saying, look, we're going to convene a panel of experts and they'll just make a decision. And that way we, the elected representatives or the members of the cabinet or the vice president, we don't have to actually make a decision. We were just told this. And of course, this is part of why there's been a backlash against experts, is that elected officials over the years have said, well, we didn't make mistakes. We were told. We were told there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We were told that there wasn't going to be a serious housing bubble. We were told, and so on and so forth. And I think that that is an unhealthy division of labor. Experts can propose, but elected officials have to dispose. And I would be wary of any solution that offloads that responsibility away from elected officials and toward making experts the deciders. Those generally should not be the same group of people. The knowers and the deciders should not usually be the same folks.
We don't have much time left, but you've also pointed out, I believe in your book, that when people lose faith in experts, problems arise, such as the anti-vaccination movement, the idea that parents yell at their kids' teachers because the kids get a bad grade. The teaching profession and the medical profession, obviously, are involved in both of those.
Right. And I think it becomes very dangerous when experts decide to take on political issues because there is so much space for argument in a way that there isn't in other places where experts ought to be respected. I think part of the problem, and this is where I point the finger at the American population, I think we really have become there's an epidemic of narcissism among the voters and among the American population who really believe that they can challenge experts about anything. But I don't think experts serve themselves well by wading into the one place where people really can challenge them, which is value judgments, moral issues, issues of public policy. And I would hate to see that happen because I think experts really need to plant the flag on the things that they know and to defend the knowledge that they are definitely certain about things like vaccines and GMOs and climate change and other things that they feel very strongly about. Okay. But to wade into politics, I think, becomes a very dangerous place for experts to be, because it encourages the public to think in exactly those very narcissistic and self-absorbed terms.
John Gardner, you started the program. We talked about your petition. We have just about 15 or 20 seconds left. Any last word that you'd like to make?
Yes, I couldn't disagree more with the idea that it's his policies and not his mental health that we need to be concerned about. As repugnant as his policies are, I am more concerned about his sanity. In his first week, he threatened to invade Mexico, Iran, and Chicago. That's crazy. So I would drop to my feet and kiss President Pence's toes. Even though I disagree with everything he stands for, he's conservative. He's not crazy.
Paul Applebaum, quickly respond to that.
Yeah, I think John Gardner doesn't have any basis for concluding one way or the other about the president's sanity. He has a strong basis for concluding that he doesn't like him. And I'm afraid that's what's being reflected here rather than any professional judgment. It's the sort of thing we ought to stay away from.
And Mark Updegrove at the LBJ Presidential Library, you're the historian. How do you think this is going to go down?
Well, I think the office of the presidency has been tarnished. It's been tainted. Okay. Whether that's irrevocable, I don't know, Warren.
Thank you all, John Gardner, Paul Applebaum, Tom Nichols, and Mark Updegrove. Great to have all of you on our program. Does liberal activism have a future in the Trump era? We'll hear how long it's taken to make a difference in a mostly minority town dominated by an oil refinery in the Bay Area of California. Back in a moment with today's Talking Point. Warren Allen here with today's Talking Point. In his introduction to a new book called Refinery Town, Senator Bernie Sanders says we need more cities like Richmond, California. He's talking about the adage that all politics is local, and Richmond is an example of what can happen when a poor, mostly black and Hispanic community gets political. The subtitle of Refinery Town is Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. The author is Steve Early. He's a veteran labor activist who moved to Richmond from the East Coast just 5 years ago. And Steve, it's great to have you in our studio.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Richmond is one of those places that ought to be a really nice place to live. It's on San Francisco Bay, the east part of the bay, near Berkeley. You can look out across the bay and you can see San Francisco. You can see Mount Tamalpais in Marin County. But very soon after you moved there, something happened that suggested that Richmond is not such a nice place after all.
Well, we have a rather large industrial neighbor on the other side of the hill from our house with a great bay view. And it is a century-old refinery, oil refinery, operated by Chevron. And a few months after we moved in August of 2012, as a result of the company's lax maintenance practices, there was a fire and explosion that did enormous damage to the refinery itself, created a toxic plume that sent 15,000 refinery neighbors fleeing for emergency rooms and clinics throughout the area. This preventable accident had a very adverse impact on local property values. It led to multiple state and federal investigations of the refinery safety practices, which had long been questioned by Richmond residents who lived downwind of the refinery. And it really triggered a lot of momentum for further change in the leadership of our city government, so that City Hall could become a place, rather than being dominated by Big Oil, where the people could put some pressure on the company to be a better neighbor and more accountable to the community.
What was it that allowed the community to organize and become a community, a town that has been in pretty bad shape for many years, a refinery town, as you indicated, pretty much run by the oil company that was effectively running the city government?
Well, the struggle against Chevron's environmental misbehavior in Richmond began actually in the 1980s, a group called the West County Toxics Coalition, which did grassroots organizing among low-income Black and Latino neighbors of Chevron, started organizing, started putting pressure on state and local refinery regulators, started protesting at the company shareholder meetings, started agitating inside Richmond city government for a more proactive approach to refinery safety and environmental health in the community. So that struggle has been going on for 30 years. It gained speed 15 years ago when a group called the Richmond Progressive Alliance was formed. And it has since then been running candidates for mayor and for city council who are pro-labor, pro-environment, committed to getting Chevron to clean up its act, pay its fair share of taxes, and help make the city a cleaner and greener and safer place. And over that 15-year period, Richmond Progressive Alliance candidates have won 10 out of 16 municipal races, quite a record in a town long dominated politically and economically by big oil.
Dominated by big oil and 100,000 or so people, so it's not a small town at all. Where'd they get the resources to win all those elections?
One of the important reforms that it was able to enact over time was a program of public matching funds at the municipal level. So just as Bernie Sanders did when he ran for president, when progressive candidates in Richmond were able to raise donations in small amounts from private donors, their fundraising would be matched with city public funds from the city. That has helped level the playing field a little bit, but of course we're up against very big bucks. Over the last three election cycles, big oil, big soda, most recently real estate interests have spent more than $7 million in Richmond municipal politics trying to elect business-friendly candidates and trying to defeat progressive ones.
Okay, the question becomes, though, how long does it take for something like this to occur? Bernie Sanders says, hey, we ought to do this in more places. You said this started 30 years ago and then really got its impetus 15 years ago. That is a long time. How do you keep people involved?
Well, you need to develop new generations of activists. And I think one of the things that I try to describe in the book is the very unusual process within the Richmond Progressive Alliance, in which its founding mothers and fathers, who tend to be folks in their 50s and 60s, over the last year or so, tried to step aside and create some space for younger people to be more active in the leadership of the organization. So its elected steering committee now is majority people of color and women. Younger people are two candidates for city council last fall who were both successful. One is in his early 40s, a Korean-American environmentalist, and our 25-year-old victor in that race was an African-American, Bernie-inspired community organizer who defeated an 85-year-old Chevron-backed African-American city council incumbent for 40 years. So the times are really changing in Richmond, both within the progressive movement and in city politics.
What are the lessons, do you think, for other cities around the country?
I think one lesson is that you have to come together with other activists who may be equally focused on their single issues. The success of the Richmond Progressive Alliance really involved people setting aside some of their political differences and uniting around a common agenda, getting involved in politics so that we're both insiders and outsiders in city government. And once you elect some people to the city council and or mayor's job who can be trusted to continue to work with the grassroots organizations that elected them, that's a great and powerful synergy that's often missing from electoral politics and in many other settings.
President Trump, in his first 4 weeks, has reversed many of the Obama-era environmental regulations having to do with oil and gas. He's going to do more without any question. Is a local battle the best way, or many local battles, I guess I should say, to combat that, do you think? Because there doesn't seem to be much chance in Washington.
Going local is a very necessary strategy over the next 4 years. In many states, it's going to be political gridlock at the state level. Certainly not much good is going to happen. At the federal level, people are going to have to wage a lot of defensive fights there to minimize the damage of the Trump years. At the local level, it is still possible to innovate, to involve people, to make change. Richmond, 10 years ago, was a pioneering sanctuary city. Its current mayor has reiterated that stand. Our police department is not going to cooperate with any Trump administration roundup of undocumented residents. And that's really essential to maintaining the progress in public safety that Richmond has made, because that has depended on rebuilding relationships of trust and confidence between the police and the community. And that would be torn apart once again if the police were in any way implicated in a roundup of undocumented people.
You came to Richmond after something like 40 years as a labor organizer and an activist in New England. And it's my understanding that you had some sense that there was something going on in Richmond that you wanted to see. Are there other places around the country that you know about where similar things are happening?
Very definitely. Our organization, the Richmond Progressive Alliance, has recently affiliated with Our Revolution, which is the network of progressives that was spawned by Bernie Sanders' inspiring presidential campaign. And Our Revolution not only backed Richmond candidates last fall, but also the new mayor of Berkeley, the new mayor of Stockton, California, 60 out of 100 Our Revolution-backed candidates for state legislative slots and city council positions, mayoral jobs around the country were successful. And we think that there's great potential for lateral networking between like-minded groups through this new formation, Our Revolution, that was spawned by Bernie's campaign.
All right. The book is Refinery Town, the subtitle Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. The author is Steve Early. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.